Now, critical analysis of the story. The story of Sunshine Lovers is rooted in the personal life of D.H. Lawrence. It would be no exaggeration to say that it is the most autobiographical of all his novels. It describes the early life and youth of Lawrence, and some of the scenes are direct transcripts from real life. Those who believe with T.S. Eliot in the impersonal theory of art may find it difficult to view Lawrence's novels with pleasure. For them, the only way of representing emotion in the form of art is by finding an objective correlative. In other words, a set of objects, a situation, a chain of events which shall be the formula of that particular emotion, such that when the external facts which must terminate in sensory experience are given, the emotion is immediately evoked. Judged from this point of view, Lawrence's novels fail as works of art, but Lawrence was too subjective a writer to ever get out of himself, and perhaps one of the charms of his novel is that they provide an intimate insight into his personal experiences and problems, his reactions to human situations, his awareness and understanding of life. In reading Sons and Lovers, one comes to know intimately the emotional stresses that Lawrence had to endure in his early years, his unhappy family life, and the urgent personal problems with which he was faced in his youth. Sons and Lovers begin with an account of the family life of the Morrells. Morrell, Mrs. Morrell of the novel, is a thinly disguised portrait of his own mother. She is a lady of some refinement and intellectual ambition. Born and brought up in the Puritan family of Coppards, she knows very little of the gay, abandon and sensuous delights of life until she meets Morrell, a minor at a dance party. He appears to her as a being from an unknown world, full of color and animation, imbued with the very joy of life. His rich ringing laugh, his wavy black hair, his ruddy face, his manly bearing win her heart. She romanticizes him into an exotic figure. To quote from the novel, "The dusky, golden softness of this man's senseless flame of life that flowed off his flesh like the flame from a candle, not baffled and gripped into incandescence by thought and spirit." And her life was seemed to her something wonderful beyond her. And to him, she seems to be a thing of mystery, a lady. A year later, they get married. But since they are temperamentally opposite, their marriage is doomed from the very beginning. Morrell's nature is non-intellectual and purely sensuous. He behaves in an irresponsible manner, drinks wine in the pub, leaves his bills unpaid, and does not share his wife's ambition of climbing up socially. He is apparently quite satisfied with his life and makes no earnest effort to fulfill his obligation as a husband. On the other hand, Mrs. Morrell is moral and religious, interested in philosophy and theology, desirous of occupying a superior position in society. She fails to understand the nature of her husband. Her efforts to make him noble, moral, and religious hurt him. He begins to neglect her, to offend her, and soon he becomes a kind of stranger to her. One cannot help feeling that Mrs. Morrell is to a large extent responsible for ruining the marriage, for she tries to impose her false values on Morrell, and not being able to do so, she nags him and disowns him. When the first child arrives, she turns all her attention to him to forget the bitterness of his disillusionment with Morrell. She makes such of the child, and the father is jealous. One day, to hurt Mrs. Morrell, the minor clips off the curls of the baby which the mother likes so much, he cruelly socks. Mrs. Morrell, who took this to heart, nurses this injury throughout her life and can never forgive her husband. Thereafter, it is a regular battle between Morrell and his wife. The more his wife tries to reform him, the more obstinately he refuses to mend his way. His grossness and drunkenness outrage Mrs. Morrell, but at the same life goes on. A second child is born. And when the third child arrives, Mrs. Morrell feels that she and her husband are guilty. She does not want this child. She no longer loved her husband. She had not wanted this child to come, and there it lay in her arms and pulled at her heart. She felt as if the navel string that had connected its frail little body with hers had not been broken. A wave of hot love went over to the infant. She held it close to her face and breast with all her force, with all her soul. She would make up it to for having brought it into the world unloved. And the third child is Paul Morel, the hero of the novel. From the long accounts of the family life given in the novel, one thing is clear. Mrs. Morel has a powerful capacity for resentment. She hates Morel's ways and is unable to reform him. She turns the children against him, making him an alien in his own home, and Morel asserts his power by bullying the children. But there are moments of happiness when Morel entertains his children by making little things for them, or when he does small household things. To quote from the novel itself, "Home was home, and they loved it with a passion of love, whatever the suffering had been." Disillusioned with her marriage, Mrs. Novel now shifts all her affection to her sons and again husband substitutes, though only one at a time. Once she seizes William, her first son, she never allows him to stay outside the range of her influence, never permits him to develop satisfactory normal relations with other women. She frowns on his love affairs with Lily, being afraid of losing him, and when William dies, we have a feeling that she is in some way responsible for his death. It is she who never allowed his manhood to flower. While Mrs. Morel is still recovering from the shock of William's death, Paul falls seriously ill with pneumonia, and when she is nursing him with all tenderness and care, she comes to realize her need of him. After his recovery, she captures his spirit, makes him her lover. From now on, her life roots itself in Paul. With the establishment of this Oedipean relations, the first part of Sons and Lovers comes to an end. The second part of Sons and Lovers explores Paul's relationship with three women: his mother, his sweethearts, Miriam and Clara. All of them offer him something, but none can satisfy his whole being. And ultimately, all the three are rejected at the end of the novel. Paul is left alone, a derelict with drift towards death. It is not difficult to see that his deep attachment to his mother, his unwillingness to hurt her, have damaged his capacity for normal sexual relations with other women. This image of his mother stands in his way. He fails to achieve a pluralized relationship with Miriam, partly due to his own insufficiency as a lover and partly due to her inability to offer him passion. Paul realizes himself the impossibility of achieving any adequate relationship with other women still till his mother is alive. His confession to his mother in chapter 13 is a clear evidence that he himself realizes what is wrong in his relations with other women. "But no, mother, I even love Clara, and I did Miriam, but to give myself to them in marriage, I could not. Belong to them. They seem to want me, and I cannot even give it to them. You have not met the right woman, and I never shall meet the right woman while you live," he said. The love affair of Paul and Miriam is set in the picture askew. Surroundings with the valley farm. To this farm, Paul first goes with his mother. He likes the place, its surroundings, and the family. During his subsequent visits to the farm, he strikes a friendship with Miriam. She resents her being neglected by her family, and when Paul shows consideration for her and offers to teach her French and algebra, the learning which she aspires after, she is only too happy to return his sympathy. She is described as a girl, romantic in her soul, and inclined to be mystical. Her intensity is such as would leave no emotion on a normal plane, and she exalts her friendship with Paul into something purely spiritual and religious. Their intimacy, to use the words of Lawrence, went on in an utterly blanched and chaste fashion. At some points, there is a touching innocence in the way Paul and Miriam behave to each other. There are idyllic moments when each uses the other as a means of exploring the possibilities of becoming future in terms not so much of education and intellectual ambition, though that does loom largely too. As of emotional fulfillment, take, for example, the scene in which Miriam takes Paul out to see the rose bush. They stand silent in rapt contemplation of beauty as their souls are kindled by the sight of the roses. It was very still. The tree was tall and struggling. It had thrown its briars over hot worn bush, and its long streamers trailed thick right down to the grass, splashing the darkness everywhere with great split stars, pure white. In bosses of ivory and in large splashed stars, the roses gleamed on the darkness of foliage and stems and grass. Paul and Miriam stood close together, silent and watched. Point after point, the steady roses shone out of them, seeming to kindle something in their souls. The dust came like smoke around, and still it did not put out the roses. Paul looked into Miriam's eye. She was pale and expectant with a wonder. Her lips were parted, and her dark eyes lay open to him. His look seemed to travel down into her. Her soul quivered. It was the communion she wanted. Paul's growing intimacy with Miriam alarms Mrs. Morrell. She does not want to lose him, and what infuriates her more is Miriam's desire to capture the soul of Paul. Had she been satisfied with physical relationship with Paul, she might not have offended Mrs. Morrell so badly. But she wants the parts of Paul which Mrs. Morrell thinks belongs to her only, and this is what Mrs. Morrell thinks of Miriam. She is one of those who will want to suck a man's soul out till he had none of his own left. She, Mrs. Morrell said to herself, and he is just such a baby as to let himself be absorbed. She never will let him become a man. She never will. And Paul to know that he belongs to his mother, that he cannot afford to hurt her without destroying a vital part of his own self, that till his mother lives, he will not be able to achieve an adequate relationship with his woman, and when he has to choose between his mother and his sweetheart, it is the former who triumphs. It could not have been otherwise. He had come back to his mother. Hers was the strongest tie in his life. When he thought round, Miriam shrank away. There was a vague, unreal feelings about her, and nobody else mattered. There was one place in the world that stood solid and did not melt into unreality, the place where his mother was. But fight as he may, Paul cannot shut Miriam out of his thought. He needs her. She fulfills something in him. His spirit needs her companionship, and in deserting her, he scares his own soul. But for all its intensity, Paul-Miriam relationship remains inadequate. Miriam offers him only spiritual love, while what Paul needs is passion. She intrudes Saul into her algebra lessons, and her intense religiosity exalts everything into disembodied spirit. She shrinks from the idea of having physical relationship with Paul. Their friendship is a matter of the soul, all thought and weary struggle into consciousness, and her inability to have the whole being of him chaps Paul. One can feel the deep anguish of Paul when he says to Miriam, "You make me so spiritual, and I do not want to be you spiritual." The dilemma of Paul is he could not leave her because in one way she did not hold the best of him. He could not stay with her because she did not take the rest of him, which was three quarters. Therefore, Paul decides to break with Miriam. His letter to her expresses the inadequacy of their relationship. "You see, I can give you a spirit love. I have given it you this long, long time, but not embodied passion. See, you are a nun. I have given you what I would give a holy nun, as a mystic monk to a mystic nun." Unable to find satisfaction with Miriam, Paul enters into a trivial relationship with Clara. She represents all that Miriam is not. She offers Paul a baptism in the fire of passion, but she cannot satisfy his soul. She cannot share his inner life. It is obvious that such an unreal relationship cannot last long. And when the husband of Clara, Baxter Dawes, beat up Paul, his defeat is complete. He has failed in all the three relationships with his mother, with Miriam, and now with Clara. Paul gives Clara back to her husband, and himself returns to his mother. But now she is ill with cancer. He arranges the best possible medical attention for her, but now it is too late. She suffers and suffers, unable to stand her misery. He gives her morphia, Morphia to hasten the end of her life. He is released from the bondage of his deep and strong love for his mother. But one wonders if he will ever be able to establish normal relationship with his woman. When we see him last, he is a lonely man, forlorn in the wide world, walking quietly towards the city's gold phosphorescence.